All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the old podcast where we talk about them movies from that Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight it's our seemingly annual tradition. Now we're going to be having on the anarcho-Christian for an Easter episode, and it's usually a biblical epic. And this is definitely one of those, as we're going to talk about the 1958 or 59 film starring the old Chuck Heston, Ben-Hur. But before we introduce the anarcho-Christian, who is our guest on the Last Night's Sports Show, let's say hello to Robert, who has video difficulties. But how are things going with you, sir?
Daniel, you'll never believe what happened. But it was a calm, unassuming day. It was a nice, beautiful Monday in the valley. And I got up and I went to work, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. There was a slight breeze coming in out of the west, and I was excited about my day. So I went to work, and I put in the work, Daniel. We did a good job. We satisfied many a customer. There was a couple of issues, but nothing too big. Nothing too big. A few alarming incidents, but I'm not going to get into those now. The main thing I want to talk about is that when I returned home, I was shocked and appalled, because as I pulled into my driveway, lo and behold, I blinked in disbelief, as there were no doubt some dirty, no good, underhanded trampoline rustlers in the valley. They had scampered off with my treasure trampoline. So, like any good citizen, I go inside and I make a Facebook post about it, right? That's what you do. This is what the world is. You complain on social media about your life.
Okay. All right.
And what happened was immediately, like within a few minutes, I get like 10 responses saying, "You're a moron. It was really windy today. It probably blew away in the breeze." And I go, "You know what? I wasn't home. I wasn't experiencing any of the wind, so I will take your word for it." But there are enough responses from people here in the valley that were like, "Oh yeah, it was really windy today. So you're probably cool. Just go look for it. It's probably nearby." So I'm like, okay. So it is pitch black, dark. I can't do anything about it. I drive around the neighborhood. I did. I get in my car and I drive around the neighborhood, but I can't see anything. All I can do is put the brights on, but you're not going to see any nooks and crannies. You're not
going to see any of those cop lights.
Exactly. You need one of those searchlights, or you need to call in the helicopter. You need some real search.
Get the canines out there.
You need some real search and rescue. And I didn't have those at my disposal. So next morning, oh, by the way, I deleted my post as soon as I realized I was a moron. It's fine. But the next morning I get up and I get dressed and I'm ready to go out hiking around my place looking for this trampoline. When I opened the door, my front door, and it had returned in the middle of the night or that morning, and it was all beat up. It was all destroyed. So my working theory is that my trampoline went out with some friends, got wasted, got trashed, got beat up by somebody, stumbled home, collapsed in the driveway, and passed out. That's okay. My working theory of what happened. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to put her down. I'm going to take her out back like Old Yeller. I don't think she's really salvageable. It's sad. But, you know, when you're working out in the country, you got to get used to death. And, you know, it's just a cycle of life, you know?
Yeah, the circle of life, like your favorite movie, The Lion King. And exactly. It sounds like your dirty tramp had a rough night, and it was her last rough night. So that's unfortunate.
Exactly. Exactly. She partied a little too hard. She probably met up, you know, with some rough folks who abused her and used her a little bit more rougher than she'd like it. And they either dumped her off at my house or she stumbled home somehow. But it, you know, I want to thank whoever kind souls did return her to me. But yeah, unfortunately, I don't even know where to look for the rest of her. She's missing pieces that are kind of crucial to her functioning. Probably what's going to happen is that, yeah, she'll just be disassembled and tossed, unless I can think of another use for the pieces.
Okay. Wow. That's an interesting story. And when you first said that it miraculously showed up the next morning at your door again, I thought it was an Easter miracle of some sort. Not on par with, you know, with the biblical tradition and what we're going to be talking about tonight, but, you know, maybe a minor one. It sounds like maybe
a minor miracle, Daniel.
Yeah, very, very minor. All right. Well, that's an interesting story. I thank you for sharing that. I'm sure that our audience really appreciates that as well. They probably would appreciate us talking about this movie. What do you think?
It's possible. You never know.
I mean, that's why they're here. You know, that's the bait anyway. So let's get into that. We will be talking about Ben-Hur with the Anarcho-Christian right after these messages. Everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are the Last Nighters. You can find us on the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel and also at lastnighters.com. You can find the episode we're talking about tonight at lastnighters.com/170. This is going to be Ben-Hur, which is the second iteration of this movie. It was originally done in 1925 and also recently done just a couple of years ago, but we're talking about the Chuck Heston classic from 1958. This was one of the big blockbusters of the time. It won a ton of awards. And it should be a lot of fun to talk about with our guest, the Anarcho-Christian, who has been with us a couple of times in the past as a bit of an Easter tradition. Last year, he was on for The Robe, and the year before that, we did The Passion of the Christ. Welcome back, Stephen, of the Anarcho-Christian. We really appreciate you joining us once again. We always have a good time with you. And why don't you remind people where they can find what you do and maybe give a you know, elevator pitch on what it is you do over at your site.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me back. And yeah, I'm enjoying this tradition. If anybody is interested, they can go to anarcho-christian.com. That's our main hub that you can find all of our articles and podcast episodes, links to the podcast platforms, and also the social media sites. And since last year, we actually were removed from Facebook. So you no longer will you find us on Facebook.
Wow. So you must be really pushing a lot of, you know, conspiracy theories and fake news and questioning the narrative and things like that. So I applaud you for that. I try to do that a little bit. Unfortunately, I also, you know, kind of depend on Facebook for a couple of things. And so I don't want to like go too far. And so they kind of got me over a barrel on that one. But yeah, that's wild, man.
It was definitely our biggest audience was through Facebook. And and not only did the page get taken down, but also I've had all sorts of arbitrary restrictions put on my personal profile. And so it's something I still haven't even gotten through yet. They keep hitting me with these random, you know, can't post to the group and different groups or anything like that. Just these random restrictions keep happening. So yeah, it's been difficult and you know, with trying to share our information like we've always done for the last few years. And just because, like I said, Facebook has had the largest audience. And so now it's gone.
Yeah, that's just bizarre. I mean, I can't imagine that you guys have posted all that much that's very controversial. I mean, just by the very nature of the content that you produce, it would seem as if it would be fairly wholesome and, you know, based on peace and like moral things, you know? And yet, and here we are, you know, I mean, maybe if you, I don't even know how to say this properly, but maybe if you identified as something else, you could just say whatever and just claim it's a, you know, it's a hate crime against you if they throttle you. I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know if anarcho in the title, maybe something that throws it off, you know, with flagging some sort of algorithm or something, but
yeah. Yeah, it's weird. You know, and you probably were a big enough target as far as like relative to us. I mean, we have a name out there, but our following's not like super big. And so maybe our day is coming as they work their way down. They probably have like a popularity sort where they're like, all right, let's take this out, this out, this out, this out. And then they work their way down the list.
For sure. I'd missed the first couple of purges and then got this last one. So.
Yeah, well, that's unfortunate. Well, anarchochristian.com, that's where people should go. And you do a show and you write articles and things like that, right?
Yes, sir. So, yeah, any of the podcasting platforms, you can catch us as well as going through the website.
All right, very good. Well, we highly recommend it. And we'll also have the links to our previous episodes with you. Like I said, it was The Robe and also The Passion of the Christ. And those were really good discussions. I recall Robert and I were a little bit nervous, especially that first one, The Passion of the Christ, because Robert and I are both atheists and you're obviously a Christian. And we were like, how are we going to talk about this controversial movie without pissing people off? And I somehow we pulled it off. So I think that has a lot to do with you and your graciousness in being able to field questions from a couple of idiots like us. So. Thanks for that.
No, I appreciate it. And yeah, it was a great first episode and The Robe as well. And so I know this one will be the same.
Well, now I got to live up to that. All right, let's see what we can do. All right. So we usually start this off with the old Google description. So let me try to pull that up here. I am getting on in years. And so these things do get more and more difficult for me as we go. Is it showing up? Oh, not yet. Here we go. There, now it's showing up, right? Everyone can see this? All right, so this is the 1959 version. It's rated G, drama/adventure film, 3 hours and 44 minutes. Ben-Hur. It got 8.1 on out of 10 on IMDb, 86% Rotten Tomatoes, 90% Metacritic, and 89% of Google users like it. The description reads, epic drama about an aristocratic Jew living in Judea who incurs the wrath of a childhood friend, now a Roman tribune. Although forced into slavery on a galley and compelled to witness the cruel persecution of his family, he survives, harboring dreams of vengeance. A battle at sea and a chariot race are among the memorable sequences. The film used 300 sets at Rome's Cinecittà Studios and won a record 11 Oscars. The record has been met, I think, twice again by Titanic and The Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. Release date, November 18th, 1959. Director is William Wyler. Of course, starred Charlton Heston. He's the biggest name in here. A budget of $15.2 million, and it made its money back. This was a big production by MGM at the time, and it was one. It started in my reading. I found out that they were working more towards a model of replicating this of a really big movie to kind of offset the losses for other movies. But their next four or five blockbuster movies after this were flops. And so they ended up in big financial trouble after that. So anyway, Robert, let's go to you for your opening, please.
All right. So does Ben-Hur still hold up in 2021? I would have to say that is yes, because it is a classically well-told story. Now, is it self-indulgent? I mean, yeah, it's 3 hours and 41 minutes. You could probably tell the story a lot quicker. But it has a really strong premise. It is a classic hero story that features a strong revenge plot, right? There's some serious injustice that goes on in this film. The child friend who knows his childhood friend is innocent of any kind of attack on this governor guy, but he wants to use him for his own political gain. So he throws him under the bus, which is essentially means he's going to kill, or at least life in prison, these people who he knew from when he was a child. It's a real villain heel turn on the part of that guy. So then you got Chuck, who goes on this journey. I kind of wish there would have been some kind of training montages almost. I don't know if this is the
era. Wait, you wanted it longer?
Well, I think montages, at least you would have gotten the sense that he was, I mean, he struggles and suffers in this movie, which is all you really need the hero to do. But at one point in time, they just kind of mention that he's like, oh, by the way, he's like the world's greatest charioteer guy. And it's just like, oh, okay. I guess he's the world's greatest charioteer now. I really wish they would have shown us that instead of just told us and given good. I mean, they kind of tell us later on as he's like talking to the horses and really understanding the horses, but still I kind of wish there was a little bit more of that aspect just to give us a little bit more of his struggle and understanding of why he's so special.
Yeah.
But, it's also told under in the backdrop in the whole kind of gimmick, I guess you can say, or setting is, you know, kind of around the time of Christ, and Christ keeps showing up in his life and kind of helping him around out. And I don't know if the movie would have been as popular if it wasn't set like this. I mean, it's also, I guess it was a really well-received book, and it's been obviously remade and told in different media. There's like a cartoon movie, and I'm sure some other forms of it. It's a well-told story. I can't complain too much about it other than, I mean, it's even got like the family drama of the mother and the sister getting leprosy, and then they don't want him to see her. It pulls on some good heartstrings. It's got some good revenge, and it's got a tyrannical state. It's a very strong, like, libertarian themed movie where, you know, it's just the eye of Sauron of the state turned against these people who were doing just fine, but his childhood friend wanted him to help out. At one point in the early days, when right before the whole drama starts, he's having this conversation because he's kind of an important, powerful kind of guy in Judea. And he's like, help me out, find out who these, you know, rebels are, and find out who these people are who are saying like negative things about Rome. This is traitorous. You have to name names.
Sounds familiar.
You got to name names about who these people are who are having some wrong think here, Judah. And Judah's like, what? What are you talking about? What happened to just, you know, having some thoughts and voicing those thoughts out loud? This is kind of like what humans do, and especially what Jews do. I don't know. They are all about debating and talking about stuff. You can't just shut down debate. You want to censor speech? No, he's like, I want to find out who these people are. And then, you know, of course, the incentive is for him to find out any kind of enemies of the state so that he can advance his political career. So these are just, you know, perverse incentives all around. And, you know, it goes, we can talk about the empire, and then we can also talk about how awesome the chariot race is, which is of course very famous because it still holds up. It was all, I mean, so much of it was very real. They couldn't fake it so much back in the day. I mean, sure, there are some puppets and other things like that, but I mean, if that's how they really did chariot races back then, it really makes NASCAR look like a bunch of wussies. I mean, there were no yellow flags whenever there was a crash.
Yeah,
they're just like a bunch of guys ran out and tried to get that stuff out of the way from the onrushing chariots. It would make NASCAR way more exciting to watch if that was the case.
Yeah, yeah, that chariot race was wild, and I'm surprised that the obvious advantage that what's his bucket had with the freaking spikes on the end wasn't like identified as, hey, this is not a fair competition if you have a weapon and no one else does.
Yeah, and the movie didn't explain why he had the weapon and nobody else did, or why they allowed it.
I figure it's he represents Rome, right? So
who's rules for thee.
Yeah,
Rome gets to cheat.
Yeah.
Well, no wonder the dude was undefeated. Anyway. Right. So Robert, a pretty good opening take and a lot of interesting discussion, I'm sure, will come out of this. But Stephen of Anarcho-Christian, what's your take on this? Is this a movie that you said you have this on DVD? You said that in the pre-show bonus content available for our Patreon supporters. So go to lastnighters.com/Patreon to hear that riveting discussion. But this must be one of your, you know, on your list of movies. you watch it pretty often. You got it on DVD. So what do you like about it, and what makes it a ripe movie for discussion with us?
Yeah, I do like this movie. And Robert, I think that you hit on just about everything, all the important points of this movie. So just to give a little bit of how I view this movie, it's very long, obviously. And I think that the first half of this movie, it's a little slower, but it really gives you a lot of that background of not just Judah Ben-Hur and his character and his family, but also everyone in that area at the time under Roman occupation. There's a lot of really good historical context that they put into that, but it's not necessarily something that's, you're not watching a documentary. They just kind of portray it through the casual conversation that the Romans have with each other. And, you know, then you see Messala and Ben-Hur and their conversations. And you don't just get the conversations between them, the personal conversations, but you also get this sort of idea, you know, you really get a good idea of what it's like under this Roman occupation. And they talk about rebellions, and they talk about the current prophet that's got everybody talking, which obviously is Jesus. And they flat out say that, you know, this happens in the year 26. And they even start out the movie with the nativity scene. So you're definitely getting a Christian film here, even though I think most people just kind of remember it for its epicness, but don't necessarily see it as a Christian film. But I definitely see it as that. Anyways, and then the movie moves on to the second half, and that's where we see the really memorable parts of the movie, the chariot scene, which is amazing visually. It just looks like you really had guys getting run over by those chariots.
Those puppets were realistic, man. My wife was like, whoa.
Yeah, it makes me cringe, you know, just when I watch it, kind of pull back a little bit, because it looks very good, which I think if I were to just guess, you know, a movie made in the 50s, and I would think that just on the onset that we would be able to see the puppets and not, I guess, have that feeling that of realism that it does have. So, but I think that's a testament as to why it's also so good and why we can keep going back to it and keep recommending it to people. You know, I mentioned that it's a Christian film. Obviously it starts and ends with Jesus. And, but in this movie as well, it's just an epic cinematic movie, like, maybe Braveheart, you know, along those lines, where if you were to recommend it to somebody, you're recommending this long movie that you're going to get into these characters, you're going to see this character development, you're going to see these people go through trials and tribulations and triumphs, and you're also going to get some sort of big payoff in the film, you know, visually, with, you know, this in Braveheart, you had the big battles, and with Helm's Deep and Lord of the Rings, this big battle and everything after a long several hours of buildup.
Yeah, slow and, build, yeah.
Yeah, and this one you have the chariot scene. And I think it's a really good movie. I think it does hold up. Of course, there are some things that are a bit dated, and it's very similar to the last movie that we reviewed with The Robe, where I think it was also made in the 50s. I can't remember exactly, but there were some things that were definitely dated in it, but there were things in it that I think are still impressive to see today.
Yeah, and I think at the time MGM was known for being the more lavish, more highly produced studio films, like throwing just a lot of resources at it. I mean, back in the heyday, you know, the Hollywood golden era, there were five or six studios that were sort of each one kind of was known for a certain thing, and MGM was like for this grand spectacle or musicals and things like that. And this was almost like their last hurrah when it comes to that kind of stuff. But you mentioned like the chariot race, and I guess they shot like so much film, and they measured it in feet, and it was over 1 million feet of film that was shot for this movie, and something along the lines of like only 20,000 feet made it into the movie itself, and it's still nearly 4 hours. So it just goes to tell you like how much shooting they did that did not make the cut, which is just wild. I mean, if you think about how they're editing this stuff, I mean, it's all like mechanically done, you know, it's like physical film. It's not like you're doing some kind of like computer program stuff. So that's just, well, it's wild that this turned out so well with that level and that kind of mechanistic editing process.
Yeah. And you've got all these well-designed, I mean, the costume design extras that are filling the screen, and you've got these incredible background portraits that are made. The background painting artists were quite excellent. And then just the set designs themselves. I mean, I know they actually filmed in Rome, so they were able to use some things that were actually there, but a whole lot of that is created and it all looked fabulous. And it just went from amazing set to amazing set to amazing set. And it really is a different time in filmmaking. I mean, these days that would all be CGI. Even with
the large crowds and the large crowds and the large columns and things like that.
Yeah. It would all be done digitally. And
yeah, like Gladiator, that overshot, like that flyover shot of Rome, where like you see this Colosseum, it looks dated now, and that's just from 2000, but it was impressive at the time, but now you're like, it's a little cringy.
And I do have, you know, obviously the rear screen projection, like with the big naval battle scenes, it doesn't look as great because, you know, you're filming on a soundstage in a big pool, and then they're shooting something or they're projecting something on the screen behind you. It doesn't look fantastic, but at least you have something to react to as the actor. You know what's behind you. You see what's there, so you can react. You're not just looking at a stick, you know, a tennis ball on a stick. So,
or a guy in a green suit,
or a guy in a green suit. So, you know, I mean, Chuck isn't the worst actor of all time. He's actually pretty decent. And I liked his performance in this one quite a bit.
Yeah, it's funny. We talked about Chuck on Planet of the Apes episode, and somebody commented like, "What? Chuck's not a great actor? Are you kidding?" And you know, because he won Best Actor for this one, and yeah, I agree. He was pretty good in this one, but I think in Planet of the Apes, it's a little over the top. You know, it's like,
no, he hams it up a little bit in Planet of the Apes. I would say this is a little more nuanced. He has more to work with. He's got better material. It's a more well-rounded character that he's playing. He's really fleshed out.
Yeah, and it's pretty amazing, like, with all the shit that he goes through. Sorry, I don't know if you can use this one later, Steven. but that he survives all of that, and really he's, like, sort of driven to survive that on the surface level with vengeance, you know, seeking revenge. But really, he's kind of helped along the way with the Jesus character, like, well, not character, but, you know, Jesus, like, sort of having touch points within the movie. Like, he's the one who gives him the water when he's collapsed and dying of thirst. That is really what's kind of underneath the surface, allowing him to continue on and persevere to finally come to the resolution. And I know, Robert, you like, you know, revenge stories. We've talked about that with like the Korean films that we've done in the past and things like that. And that always has like a nice feeling, you know, like, yeah, he's going to get him back, you know, like he's been wronged and he's going to get him back. But this movie sort of like plays into that, but then takes it up a notch, you know, Guy Fieri style, with forgiveness actually being more powerful. And anarcho-Christian, I'm sure you can kind of speak to that, but as, you know, libertarian anarchists, we're very much of, Robert and I are very much of the mind of, you know, self-defense and consequences are things that help to, manage society and wrongs done in society. And so you don't need an overriding state to monopolize those types of things. But I know Bob Murphy, he's a big Christian and he's a pacifist. And I kind of see that angle in this with the forgiveness over vengeance. So I wanted to see if you could speak to that for a moment.
Yeah. And I think that they portray it really well, where that vengeance, the reason why we do talk about forgiveness, and I guess in the sense of, you know, how it even affects you. And we see the character from Charlton Heston, we see Ben-Hur consumed with hatred, right? And then the ways that we see him, as well as I forget the other character's name, that the daughter of his former slave,
Hester.
Esther, that's right. So, you know, we see them encounter the message of Jesus. They have the Sermon on the Mount, what appears to be the Sermon on the Mount, and then it's confirmed later when she's talking with him, where she starts saying what she heard, you know, this man say up on the hill, and she starts repeating lines from the Sermon on the Mount and the gospel accounts. And so the way that it's portrayed here is definitely in line with the Christian message of, you know, forgiveness. And it's, you know, it's what we do. We forgive the other person, but also, you know, that affects you internally as well.
Yeah. Now I also thought of present day, like, incursions on liberty and overreach by a dang near totalitarian state, totalitarian government, similar to what the Roman Empire was imposing upon Judea. And I know that some people would consider that hyperbole, though I don't think that it is. I mean, essentially, you've had the government, the state, almost worldwide, seize the means of production. You know, they dictate how many people your business can serve, whether you can even be open, whether you're deemed an essential or non-essential worker, things of that nature. So, I mean, it doesn't get much more totalitarian than that. And of course, now they're talking about vaccine passports, which is, I think, the Alex Jonesian total control grid. So I was sort of viewing this story from 1959, or this movie from 1959, based on a novel from, I think, the late 1800s, mm-hmm. talking about events of over 2,000 years ago, or about 2,000 years ago. And I was just like, wow, the parallels are just amazing. And what lessons can we draw from this, based on, you know, what you were just talking about, on how to deal with and overcome the present day situation that we're all dealing with?
Yeah, I agree. There are a lot of similarities with what we can see today and what we see portrayed here. And it's portrayed well. And so we can see those similarities. And people all the time relate the United States to Rome, and that, and you don't even have to be someone who's like anti the United States to do that. Even someone who's a patriot will look at certain declines in society and compare it to Rome. And we can see that here in this movie, I think, portrayed through this idea of empire moving into this area. And it's not hard, I think, for anyone to kind of put themselves in this position of what it's like to be on the receiving end of that. And I think the important point is to go all the way with that feeling, you know, where if you can identify that this seems very much like a totalitarian state, and it's, you know, it's a, the actions look like something that's happening now. Well, we need to, you know, follow that thought through all the way and not make excuses because it happens to be our totalitarian state, you know, where we are here on this land now. So sometimes it's hard, I think, to follow it through, make those connections, because, you know, in this movie, it's, you already have a group of people in Palestine, and then you have the Romans move into that area. So that difference maybe is the reason why it's a little difficult to make the connections to follow all the way through with the thought.
Right. Yeah. And one of the things that really struck me was Mark Claire of the Lions for Liberty, or Lions of Liberty podcast. He had a tweet that sort of gone viral. People have taken screenshots of it and are spreading it around, where he's basically talking about these vaccine passports and how if you're for forcing people to take these vaccinations, then you are my enemy. And I agree with that in a lot of ways, but, you know, in watching this movie and you know, I was a church going lad, you know, forgiveness is portrayed in this movie as, you know, love your enemy, be kind mm-hmm. to your enemy. And I'm seeing the people who wish to impose this upon us in present day as an enemy. So how would one react? What would one do to both resist this, but also, you know, follow along with these teachings that are sort of portrayed in this film?
Yeah, I think that one of the more difficult points of looking at this from the outside is sometimes the idea is that if you're forgiving, then that action doesn't matter, or that action isn't bad or immoral or harmful in some sort of way. It definitely is. It still is immoral to force people to do these things. It is still a bad action, you know. So the idea of like we should forgive someone doesn't take that away. And so I'm not saying everybody thinks that, but I think that sometimes that's there, and that's a difficult hurdle to get over. And from that point, we look at things that we've seen portrayed throughout history from different groups of people. And the way that I like to look at it, that I think is the most useful for us right now, because it was so close to us in history, would be the civil rights movement and the nonviolence and the non-aggression that was used during the civil rights movement. I think that that is one of the closest things that we have to the actual acts of forgiveness physically that we can see other people doing. And it's the closest in history, I think, for us to really get a good understanding of. And if I can add one more point to that, it would be that in our faith, there's a lot of emphasis on the heart motive. It's not just these physical acts that we call forgiveness of, you know, if we're resisting nonviolently, or if we're giving someone food, even though they're hungry, but yet they're someone who's considered our enemy, things like that, these physical acts. But more importantly, and where the true forgiveness really does come from, is from inside. So it's this heart motive that we have to have as well.
Yeah, the thing I love about forgiveness is not only is it freeing. I mean, I don't know if it ever truly frees the guilty party of their guilt, but it certainly frees yourself of that pain and suffering and revenge fantasy and that kind of thing. Because that is destructive, and that is portrayed fairly well in this film. I really did enjoy that aspect of it, because it's a little more complex. You get a lot of just flat out revenge stories. And it's also interesting how the movie, his primary motivation is just to find out what happened to his mother and his sister and to make sure that they are freed and they are safe. And then it's really only when he finds out or thinks that they're dead does he go into full on rage kill mode, which I think is completely understandable and justifiable for all the horrific acts that, and just petty power grabs that the guy was doing. But I think another cool thing that this movie talks about and really kind of makes apparent, and I might just be flashing back to some other movie that I've been thinking of, but I'm pretty sure that when Judah is talking to his childhood friend, the main villain, can't think of his name.
Marsala. I was thinking Tikka Masala. It's Masala.
Tikka Masala. When he's talking to Tikka Masala, and you know, Masala's talking like, okay, listen, these people of Judea, they're a beaten people. We conquered this place. They need to, you know, get in line and support the emperor, and Rome is awesome, and we do everything awesome, and we help people out by ruling them. And Judah's like, you know, you may have conquered this land, you can kill all its people, but we'll never be defeated. I mean, we will always resist you as foreign invaders, essentially, is what he's saying. And this is basically what I'm recalling. And that's just true, a truism throughout history everywhere you go. Anytime there's empire, you are creating resistance. And we've talked about this till we're blue in the face, but this is another example here in this film.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And that was one of the things I really liked. Also, just related to that scene was, you know, they were, of course, establishing that Masala and Judah were old friends, childhood friends, you know, family friends. They all knew each other. The sister was, you know, hot for Masala way back in the day. And Masala was counting on that friendship, that bond of friendship, to be enough of a motivator to get him to turn in fellow people. And Judah, of course, knew that that meant that those people would be imprisoned or murdered. And I really enjoyed that he stuck to principle over friendship. And a lot of people will equate, you know, friendship being a principle, like you want to be true to your friends, you know, the whole bros before hoes thing. But in this example, you know, the friend was obviously using that relationship capital in a harmful way. And I think Judah was very stoically, you know, like made the right decision to adhere to his principles and not turn anyone in. I mean, he was even willing to go so far as to dissuade people he knew that were going to actively resist the empire as a favor to his friend. You know, he was willing to go so far and try to like, you know, speak reason to them or just let them know like, hey, there's this guy and he's going to like come down on you real hard. So maybe it's not such a good idea to do this stuff. And the fact that he spurned his friend who put him in an impossible situation. I mean, you can't win either way. You've either murdered people or you're betraying your friend. And I think he made the right call. Robert, I know that's a thing that would probably stick with you. What was your thought on that?
Oh, yeah. No, that was a real class move by Judah, because obviously Tikka Masala wasn't acting like a friend in that instance. He was, like you said, using that friend capital to get him to do something absolutely immoral and against his conscience. And he was like, you know what? If you're not going to be a friend, you're not going to act like a friend, then you're not my friend. And you're definitely not acting like a friend when you're asking me to rat out people who just have the wrong ideas. And you're going to physically assault them, possibly murder them, totally ruin their lives for having the opinion that Rome is an evil oppressor. I mean, for knowing the truth, this is what I'm supposed to rat out my friends for. Yeah, you can take a hike. So good on him.
Yeah, and it's another thing I see like current day parallels with, you know, like with the whole pandemic perspective and people turning other people in for not wearing masks or wrong think or sharing fake news or whatever. Or is it even like, is fake news even the thing anymore? Or was that just election style stuff?
Yeah, I think that was just from the previous administration. So maybe it doesn't exist anymore.
Right. Well, now there's just a narrative that's pushed and they ignore any contrary evidence or any contrary opinion from any other expert of equivalent stature. It's really bizarre. It's really quite bizarre. And so many people...
I saw a really hard hitting piece today about,
I'm already laughing about it.
Biden's dog pooping in the hallway. So that was some intense journalism right there.
Dang. Yeah. Yeah. The hard hitting questions. Yeah. It's
what's
so
really
amazing
going on in the White House. Who's pooping where?
It's so amazing to me that people can't see through this stuff. You know, they're just so blinded by some, I don't know if it's like an ideology, really. It's more just like an implanted programming. You know, it's that NPC, like a lie is repeated enough times from enough places and enough sources to where it becomes truth. And the bigger the lie, the easier it is for people to buy into it. There's a couple of quotes I've seen recently. One was by Carl Sagan, the, you know, billions and billions, the cosmologist guy.
Yep. Mm-hmm. The astrophysicist.
Yeah, and he was basically saying, like, you know, once people have bought into something like this, it's really hard to shake them from that because they've invested a lot into this belief system. And even if you show them, and I'm, of course, paraphrasing, if you show them contrary evidence, I mean, they're just going to ignore it completely because they have already bought into the con. And this is something that you and I have talked about on shows in the maybe about a year ago when the lockdowns first started happening. And my point at the time was, you know, they can't back off on these lockdowns now because that would be an admission that they were wrong and they can't do that.
Right.
So, you know, they have to find a way to walk this back. But of course, it just keeps ever encroaching.
And that's not just people who are making these lockdowns happen, people of the states, but the people who bought into it.
Oh, yeah.
Know, early on, or, you know, your friends and neighbors that have been so affected by the lockdowns and by the narrative coming from the CDC and the state. They're so bought into it, they can't see the, you know, good information that has also come about now that we have a year's worth of information.
Yeah, it's like they're allergic to good news. I mean, anything that is positive, they will ignore it completely. And it seems like they're addicted to this doom. What do they call it? Doom porn?
But, you know, the lockdowns caused real actual harm. And they have to, in their mind, believe that the pandemic would have been worse had they not locked down, and that the pandemic would have been caused more harm than the lockdown does. So they have to.
That's why they hate Sweden and they hate Florida.
Yeah.
And South Dakota.
They have to ignore those places and you know, ignore all kinds of evidence. So it's an emotional thing that you it's you know, it's picking sides on a team and then rooting and cheering on your team and then rooting against the other team, even though the other team is actively trying to help you. Whatever.
Right. All right. Well, let's steer back to the movie. I know you successfully did that on me last time I went on this present day rant. The other thing I really enjoyed was that there was this determination when he was on the ship as a rower, and he survived on there for three or more years. And most people would have died after a year or so. And the commander who was on the that lead ship saw the intensity in Charlton Heston, in Judah's character, that he was drawn to him, and he thought he could be a good gladiator, or, you know, he could utilize that intensity. But that was like this burning desire for vengeance and for seeing, well, not just vengeance, but, you know, seeing that his family was safe and also getting back at Masala. But I also really thought that, and maybe it's a foreshadowing kind of thing, because it's really before Judah was really exposed to the concepts of forgiveness, but he demonstrated forgiveness when that ship sank and he saved that guy and also prevented him from killing himself, falling on his sword for, you know, losing his battle. And then that ends up being a really good thing for Judah. He gets adopted as a son by that guy, because he had lost his son in the past. And it's an example that we see where, even though he was an enemy, he was the one, he was basically the figurehead of what was imprisoning him, at least locally. And he was still able to forgive him to the point of saving his life and also preventing him from killing himself, to build a bond that he was then able to springboard into this montageless becoming the greatest horse chariot rider in all of Rome in just a few short months. Now, I thought that was a pretty cool story as well.
Yeah, but I didn't. It's funny you saw that as a forgiveness aspect. I saw it as a very pragmatic move of somebody who was like, all right, this guy's my meal ticket. I want this guy to not die. So how do I save this guy from getting killed? And I need this guy alive because he's actually going to help me get to where I need to be. Now, it's true, he could have tried to swim over to the other side, but it seemed to me like this was a pragmatic move as opposed to a forgiveness move.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't think that he thought that he was going to use him as leverage. I thought he was just saving him because he could mode of forgiveness, because, I mean, they're in the middle of the ocean, or the, you know, Adriatic Sea, or wherever the battle commenced. And they didn't know, you know, when the ship was on the horizon, they're like, well, if it's this ship, then we're both screwed. And if it's this other kind of ship, then just one of us is screwed.
Yeah, I think that the whole dynamic here in this portion of the movie was really good. You see the Arius, the commander of this ship, and I think of the whole legion, there was something that drew him to Ben-Hur, and I think it was that drive that you guys have referenced already. Like, he had this drive to survive, you know, and so you combine that drive to survive that Judah has with, also, he has been shown a little bit of grace here on the ship. He had the opportunity to kill Arius there in his room when he just showed up and he was sleeping, you know, and then he had this opportunity to either kill him or let him die, you know, during the siege on this boat and then on the raft. And so it is kind of this, it's not a direct one-for-one reason, like, why this is happening. You know, I think that we just see this really interesting dynamic between the two.
Could be a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. I'm not exactly sure how to play it, but it's interesting that different people are having different takes on it. That's fun.
Yeah, I definitely see a little forgiveness and a little self-preservation kind of coming together. And you have these two men that are, Judah's thankful for being unlocked from the shackles. And then you have Arius that's thankful for being saved and forced not to fall on the sword later. And so it just gives us this very interesting dynamic between the two.
Right. Yeah.
And then form that bond between them.
Yeah. Yeah. And also when he, went into his room, and it seemed like Arius didn't remember that he had called him there, and he could have killed him. Judas says to him, "I'm not ready to die yet," because he knows that if he does kill Arius, there's going to be immediate consequences shortly thereafter. And he's still on this like mission of finding his mother and sister. And so he, that prevents him. And it, similarly to how, when he had a spear at Tikka Masala, he's like, yeah, I could strike him down now, but what would happen to my mom and sister? You know, they would die as well.
Oh, so that reminds me,
that's what held him back, I think, in both of those cases.
That reminds me, there were multiple times during watching this movie that I was like, oh, George Lucas watched this movie when it inspired him for Star Wars. Because at one point, Arius says to Judah, it's like, yes, use your hate or your anger. It will make you strong. And then there was another line, I forget where, that was like similar to something said in Star Wars. And I was like, mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. You're just copy and pasting for Star Wars. I mean, it works. You're taking the best things and then putting it in there.
Was it when Masala was trying to face him after he had been trampled? Didn't he say something about?
I don't know.
Something about the revenge that he was still seeking. I also thought that was pretty badass that Masala was like, you know, you could cut off my legs to save my life, but I need to face this man who I betrayed. As a man, you know, as a whole man, just out of like honor or whatever, even though he'd done a very dishonorable thing earlier, obviously, but that cost him his life. I mean, he could have, I guess he doesn't know that he was definitely going to die as a result of that decision, but I think he knew that delaying having what needed to be done was increasing the risk of him dying.
For sure.
Yeah, this is a really good scene, you know, coming off of this chariot race, but then which is a big intense scene, but then you have this smaller intense scene where I think Masala did the actor did a really good job of portraying this man that's been completely, you know, run over by the horses and chariots. And you could just hear it in his voice that, you know, that he's got broken ribs and he is just not in good shape.
Yeah,
for sure.
Wild. So we are actually almost out of time, sadly. So I want to make sure that we cover off any, you know, other important notes that anyone has taken. Robert, do you have anything else on your list or any other points you want to bring up?
You know, I don't. I didn't take down any notes. I know this is one of those movies where either you take down a whole ton of notes or you take down zero notes, because there were all kinds of key moments, interesting points, where especially from like a libertarian, you know, empire take, where he's got some trumped up charge. And in that time, they don't just like charge the one guy with, I guess it would be something akin to domestic terrorism, right? I mean, they're assaulting a god figure on you know, a government guy, right? Like, you know, with the Capitol quote riots or insurrection, their response has been way bigger than any other of the riots. Oh, well, you're just destroying some of the peasants' property. Who cares? But you're actually attacking the temple of the sacredness. There's even at one point, who was it? The Buffalo guy was hanging out in the Congress room. And like the guard there was like, you're in the sacred room. Everything is the most sacred here. It's like, could it be more of a religious thing to you people?
But, yeah. But that guy, I mean, he waltzed in there and said hi to the guy. You know, it's
he's
just
defiling
bizarre.
the sanctum sanctorum, Daniel.
Yeah, I get your point. Yeah, the state will always. There's a Rothbard quote. It's like, okay, well, if we look at how the state handles crimes committed against citizens versus how crimes against the state are handled, we'll see what's really important to the state. Paraphrasing, of course. So I'll put it on the show notes page. But I mean, it's highlighted so much in this example and also in current day. I keep bringing this movie to current day. I don't know why.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine why it would be relevant today.
I think that's easy to do.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, do you have any other points you wanted to bring up? Maybe how this relates to Easter, or, you know, because it is kind of an Easter movie for us, or an Easter special, as Easter's coming up right around the corner here when this episode comes out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that this movie just hits on so much, and that's why we can watch it today and get so much to take away from it. You have several parallel stories that are happening at the same time. And it's not surface level where you just have just simply a revenge story. You know, it's not just a guy going out just because he was wronged on one thing. You know, we see this drive from him looking for his mom and sister, and then also this sort of vengeance on the man who did this to his family. And then also this man is this representative of this oppressive empire that's moved onto his land. So also not just oppressing him and his immediate family, but then also his people. I think it's all portrayed very well, and it gives us a lot to talk about. And then you couple that with the historical aspect to it. That's something that I love about these movies, is that it brings the biblical stories and the biblical narratives that we've heard our whole lives, and it makes them more real. It takes them off of that real clean piece of paper with, you know, gold edging on the paper and in the Bible, and it makes it real. It makes it the history and the historical aspect of it real. That we see the dirt on the ground, you know, and it just makes it more real. I think that that's a habit that we all have, and I do myself, where you end up looking at these as just these stories that are kind of disconnected from history. And so when I see them portrayed in movies like this, I really enjoy it. It kind of brings it back into reality, that this really did happen in the year 26 to 33, I think, you know, where we're watching this movie and the way that they've shown it on this timeline. And I really enjoy that aspect of the movie. And I think that when I do recommend this movie, it's something that I like to point out, like kind of pay attention to that aspect of the movie. Because I think it just makes it fascinating, especially when they do a good job of portraying it. And we see these instances that are kind of woven throughout the story with the nativity and the Sermon on the Mount, and just a little piece of the trial and crucifixion of Jesus, where the passion was hours long of just the trial and crucifixion. And I would say, if there's one thing about that aspect of the movie that they didn't show, that they stopped it before the resurrection. The movie ends at the crucifixion. Spoiler alert, sorry. But
if you haven't seen a movie from 65 years ago. Yeah.
But they ended there with the crucifixion. And on one hand, I could see, I mean, we're already almost 4 hours into the movie. It doesn't really, I think, for the story of Judah, it doesn't need to continue on any longer. But then an interesting aspect of it, I don't know if you noticed, but it seems a little out of place that the music from the point of the crucifixion, when Jesus dies and they experience the storm and the darkening of the sun, which all of that is accurate to the biblical narrative and to history.
I remember that in The Passion, Mel Gibson's movie.
Right. Right. So that happens. But then if you notice, and I thought it was interesting that they chose this, and I think it's because they weren't going to continue the story into the resurrection, but the music sounds very triumphant. And so it seems a little out of place, except that if you, I guess, know that they're referencing that there is a triumph here on the cross, that it's not just a sadness of Jesus dying on the cross, but there actually is a triumph that's happening here with Jesus dying on the cross for our sins. And we also know, because we're familiar with the story, that there will be a resurrection in 3 days.
Right. Yeah. And it's the wise man, is it Balthazar? He sort of narrates that sort of perspective of it, you know, like, this is not a sad event. This is a sacrifice, and it's a painful endurance, but it is actually leading to a greater thing, which is redemption.
Yeah, they did a really good job of introducing those biblical, very, very important points that are made. If you read the actual narrative, they didn't set out to make a movie of the gospel, right? But we're introduced to these gospel nuggets and these truths through the interactions that Judah has with Balthazar and with Esther. And I think that that is just a very compelling form of storytelling, where we're not just remaking the same gospel account movie over and over again. And so I'd love to see more movies made with that sort of attention to detail.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. Like, you think about, you know, Christian movies being like Christian music back in the day, like not very good. But then back in the 50s, like so many of these stories were blockbuster epics, you know, mm-hmm. Ten Commandments and Ben-Hur and The Robe, and even Spartacus has biblical stuff in it, right?
You know, I don't remember Spartacus, if it did. The Robe did. We did that last year. And yeah, it was very, very similar to this movie. And really the only thing that I think The Robe was missing was this epic chariot race that this movie kind of has instead of The Robe. But I don't remember if Spartacus had that. I'm going to have to revisit that and check.
All right. Well, definitely the Ten Commandments.
Yes, for sure. That one is, you know, a story for, you know, of the Old Testament story.
Right. Yeah. So I'd love to do either of those next year or sooner. I mean, it doesn't need to be an annual thing.
Right. Well, yeah, we should do Ten Commandments that maybe before Easter. Next Easter.
Yeah, before next Easter. Yeah. And then I know when Robert and I did Trumbo recently, he had written much of the script for Spartacus, and it was and it's not a well-known thing, but it was a Stanley Kubrick directed film. And when I mentioned that to you, you're like, oh man, we should do that sometime too. So
yeah, I had no idea that Spartacus was a Kubrick film. That is definitely not, I guess, at the top of the list whenever I think about Kubrick or anybody talks about their favorite Kubrick films. I don't ever see Spartacus mentioned. So yeah, I was a little surprised by that.
Yeah. You see like some of the less common ones like Barry Lyndon or Lolita, of course, The Shining 2001 and things like that. But yeah, Spartacus, I don't think is hardly mentioned. Like I remember there used to be like this Kubrick set of like DVDs you could get at Costco. This is like 20 years ago. And it had like six or seven movies. And I don't know if Spartacus was one of them, but.
Right.
Maybe
yeah,
not.
Yeah, I'd be surprised. I think Spartacus is thought of more as like a studio film and less of like the art house Kubrick style. But
yeah, that's a good way to show that distinction.
Yeah, well, this has been great, Stephen. Why don't we get into some final summary and review, and maybe we can give it a rating of, you know, however many laps around the circus that we give this out of 10. We'll ding down some dolphins, which I think was how they were counting the laps. So, Robert, why don't you lead us off with your final summary review and how many dolphins or how many laps out of the circus for you?
All right. So, Ben-Hur, does Ben-Hur go burr in 2021? Yes, it does. It's a different style of filmmaking. Anything made that long ago is going to be just different. They're going to sit the camera in one spot because you've got static. You know, you got a static fake background that only looks good from one angle because that's the way they set it up. That's how they did it back then. If you move the camera a little bit, it's going to look off and it's going to look weird and it's not going to work. So it's a lot of static shots, but it is still the splendor. You know, you're dealing with gangsters of the highest order, like government is today. You've got, you know, the splendor of Rome, all that stolen loot on display. They're all blinged out. You got the golden breastplates and the whole kit and caboodle. Everybody's doing the Roman salute, so you feel like you're in Nazi Germany a little bit. So that's fun. You know, it's a well-told story. It's got a lot of popular themes. It'll be instantly recognizable to a modern audience if you're really paying attention, if you don't get bored easily. Because it is a little bit on the slow side. It's a little self-indulgent. It's just a different style of filmmaking than you get today. So, but everything is real, you know, for the most part, except for the rear screen projection stuff. But that's the best technology they had at the time. So you gotta give, you know, some forgiveness there. The acting is all excellent.
The script is strong. It inspired a lot of other filmmakers, I'm sure. This is just one of the big benchmark films, one of the last great big hurrahs of classic Hollywood epics, in the vein of like Cleopatra and stuff like that. And they redid it again a few years ago. I don't know if the redo is any good, but I saw the star rating was still quite high on Amazon. So I was like, hey, there you go. I mean, it's a classic story. I'm going to give this one 8.5 upturned fish, 8.5 laps around the circus out of 10 for 2021. This is for a modern audience. I still think it's really, really strong. If you can devote the time and the energy and the focus to really pay attention to what's happening, because there is that tendency to get a little bit bored in the slow pacing, but I still think it's strong. It's still worthwhile. The hook of the film with the big betrayal and the tyranny of the state really hooked me. I think it'll hook the average viewer also, but it will really hook like a libertarian minded person, anybody that has any kind of healthy distrust of government.
Of which most people should, especially by now.
I would hope so. I would hope so.
All right, very good. So 8.5 laps around the old circus. So that was right around the time Masala got trampled, I think, in the film. So, Steven, what's your final summary and review, and how many laps do you give this?
Can I just say exactly what Robert said?
All right, yeah, let's just rewind the tape.
No, I agree with everything that you said. This movie, it's long. I think that it could be intimidating to some to want to commit to that sort of a sitting down for that long of a movie, especially an older movie. But I think it's a lot like intentionally picking up a long book. You know, you're picking this up, you're going to dive into it, and it's going to take you a long time to finish it, but the payoff is definitely there. You know that it's there. It's there on a lot of things with the acting, of course, the chariot scene. And I think the complexity of the story, where we are seeing a very well portrayed empire occupying this area. We're seeing a well portrayed story of a man going from a wealthy family to a slave to then an adopted son of a high Roman official, and then back to find his family and maybe regain his fortune or save his people or something. You're getting this story that's very long, and it goes through a lot, and it's well done in that regard. Yeah, there's a few things that are a bit dated, but I think that it's easily something that anybody can ignore or just kind of accept for what it is. But for the most part, it definitely holds up to being something that can be watched today and enjoyed. And I think just you don't have to watch this just as a chore to, because you have to knock out a top 50 movie, you know, list of movies or something like that, or for school or for something like that. I think it's something that can be enjoyed by anybody at any time. And that's just from the film perspective. And then from the faith perspective, because I think it is a little surprising at how much this movie is a Christian movie, where it surprised me to see it start with the nativity story. And so that seems unrelated if it's just a movie about Judah Ben-Hur. And, but that it starts with the nativity, it ends with the crucifixion, and we get some really good biblically accurate, gospel nuggets thrown in there. Some good summations of biblical accounts and repetition of Bible verses in there, thrown in as just normal, relatable and realistic conversation between people. So I'm going to agree with the 8.5. I think that is a very fair score. And I think that this is something that should be on a list and of great all-time movies, and everybody should watch it.
All right, very good. So pretty high praise from both of you guys for this spectacular and splendor, visually splendorous film with all these practical effects. And it's one of the last hurrahs, as Robert was saying, of the glory of the big studio epic productions with thousands of extras and hundreds of sets and tens of thousands of stage props and costumes and all of that. And it really shines through. It's a really good story. And it's one of those kind of amazing things that something that's almost 4 hours long, you almost want it to be longer because some of the things feel a little bit glossed over, as you were saying, Robert. So it's kind of surprising that way. And as much as I enjoyed our episode on Snyder Cut last week, I actually liked this movie better. And I was able to watch this over just the course of two nights versus 4 or 5 nights that it took us to watch Snyder Cut. And I was a little bit surprised. I don't know if you watched the same exact version that I did, because there was a 6.5-minute overture at the very beginning of the movie, the version that I watched of this movie. And then the intermission happens, and it's like another 2 or 3 minutes of just a title card and then just music. And I could have sworn if you had seen both of those things, it would have been brought up.
I did see those things. I did. Okay. I understand that those are time, you know, those things. I mean, the initial overture, I'm not exactly understanding why they do that. But I mean, the intermission, of course, you know, people's bladders are going to burst. And this is the only time you're going to see this movie is in the theater. So, you know.
Yeah, way back in the day.
Have some humanity, Daniel.
Well, if anything, that I felt like the overture should have been shorter and the intermission longer if it's going to be a bathroom break.
Yeah. Totally agree.
But yeah, I mean, it was really a great movie to watch. It's one that I had not seen before in my recollection. I'm sure it's like had been on in the past, like maybe on Turner Classics or something like that. But I've never sat down and watched the whole thing all the way through. And it's a compelling story, and it's very well done. And I'm very glad that you recommended it, Stephen. So thank you for that. It's been a lot of fun talking with you tonight on this.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun for me as well.
All right, very good. So I hope you can stick around a little bit longer. We do.
Whoa, Skippy. Whoa.
All right.
Hold up the reins on them horsies.
Oh,
what was your rating there, buddy?
All right. So you guys both gave it 8.5. So significance wise, I'm going to give it an 8. And what does that do for us? It brings us up to 26 overall. Yeah. The three stories combined. And this based in 80-26, so there we go. Numerology. I'm giving this an 8. 8 okay. Laps around the chariot race. Right before the pileup on turn 3 when Masala gets trampled. By the way, that guy, Stephen Boyd, he did his own stunt of like sliding under the chariot and holding on. So that's pretty badass. It's it was a pretty cool looking thing. So well done, Stephen Boyd. Well done, Charlton Heston. You won Best Actor, 11 awards for this thing, and it still holds up to this day. And that's what happens when you do a quality story with quality production. So not that we would know that here on our show, but we have Stephen, who has a quality production over at anarcho-christian.com. So do check that out. So Robert, next week, just out of pure happenstance, we were planning to do an episode with our buddy Mike of the Battle for Liberty podcast. And we were on his show way back in the day, like 4 or 5 years ago. His show's on hiatus now. And we had planned to do an episode on Robin Hood, the Ridley Scott version with him. That's, of course, the movie we're going to be doing next week, years ago. And it never happened. It always fell through. And we finally got it arranged. And this is maybe a couple of weeks ago. And then out of the blue, 2 days ago, he's like, "Hey, I'm in town. You want to hang out?" So we hung out last night. He came to my house and we hung out by the fire, had a few beers, chatted for a couple hours, and we'll be chatting with him next week, talking about Robin Hood. So pretty wild stuff. He's a cool guy, and he's the best kind of cop, former cop. And, you know, he found he had ideological differences with his job and he left his job. So I applaud him for that. And he's a really good guy. And I'm very excited to have him on for that.
Yeah, I remember that guy. I remember we did a couple of episodes with him a long time ago, but they were always really good. So yeah, should be awesome.
Yeah. So a lot to look forward to next week with the old Robin Hood. We got a whole slate of films lined up, some really exciting stuff. I think we're booked up through almost July now. So Robert, if you have any movies that you want to get in there, let me know, because I just keep booking this up.
You're doing fine, Daniel. Keep up the good work, buddy.
All right. Well, we'll do. We'll do for sure. And Stephen, thanks again. Why don't you give a final plug where people can find what you do, and then we'll get into some bonus content after that.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, guys. Number three, I guess, in the books, and hopefully we can continue to do this. And if anybody is interested, anarchochristian.com is the main hub. And there you'll find links to, you know, various articles and book reviews and the podcast as well, which can be found on any of the podcatcher platforms. And if anyone has any questions, you know, feel free to reach out to me through the website or through the various social media accounts. We're no longer on Facebook, but you can still find us on Twitter, Instagram, MeWe, and Minds.
All right. Very good. Well, I do recommend that people do check out your work. I know that you do really good stuff. I've listened to a couple of shows, and I'm not a Christian myself, and I still found them entertaining, as well as the previous times you've been on with us. So thanks again for doing this. And we look forward to having you on again in the near future. And also, you know, keep up the annual Easter tradition, but maybe add another one in there or something like that. I don't know. It might be fun.
Yeah, we should definitely do the Ten Commandments one of these days, or maybe even visit one of those modern, you know, Christian films or something, you know, and kind of mix it up instead of just visiting these epic ones.
Yeah, hey, we could do a Kevin Sorbo movie and talk about what a badass that guy is, or a Kirk Cameron movie.
Yeah.
But Kevin Sorbo is a badass on Twitter. That guy's
He is. Yeah. I remember that. Yeah, that would be fun. So yeah, definitely. We'll do something again in the future. So that's our episode, everyone. So if you like what we do, of course, check out our guest, anarchochristian.com. Hit us up on our Patreon. You go to lastnarrative.com/Patreon, get some pre-show and post-show bonus content. We call the post-show content Kathleen Turner Overdrive. And also we have the show notes for this at lastnarrative.com/170. And we'll have links to all the stuff over here that we've been talking about. And then Robert's got a merch site at trubster.com. That's trubbster.com. And you can support him that way. And you can support us just in general by, you know, living free as best as you can. You know, don't let all this stuff get you down. We'll find forgiveness and turn the other cheek, or whatever the appropriate advice is. But I think that eventually, the truth must win out, right? I mean, I got to believe that. Otherwise, it's just depressing. So hopefully they've overstepped, and eventually people will come around. And that's my hope. But anyway, we will get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive right after this. Thanks for listening. And we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, and we're going to continue the transmission just a little bit longer on the Actual Anarchy podcast. I felt like I train wrecked the end of that one, as I tend to do. I also forgot to mention that we're going to be on Keith Knight's Don't Tread on Anyone in the next couple of weeks. We're going to be recording with him actually tomorrow night, and I'm not sure exactly when that's going to be coming out, but we're going to be talking with him about three libertarian movies, or movies with libertarian message, that we really like from each of us. So Keith, me, and Robert. So there's going to be nine total. So there's going to be chock full of recommendations. It's almost a top 10 list. It's going to be a lot of fun. But anyhow, with the Actual Anarchy episode, which I don't believe I mentioned the episode number, it's 227. So go to actualanarchy.com/227. And I like to save a question for the end here. And this one, Robert, I want to direct to you, and then we'll go to Stephen. What was your take on the mother and the sister saying, "Don't tell Judah that we are alive. We want him to remember us how we were, because now we have leprosy and we're resigned to this awful, you know, living condition. And it's better that he thinks that we're dead." Now, of course, this advances the plot, right? Because if Judah doesn't know or doesn't know that they're alive still, then he doesn't have that vengeance seeking against Masala for the race. But when I was watching this, I was like, no, come on, mom. Don't just let him think that he's dead. You know, that's almost worse. What was your take on that?
Yeah. So as a son, which I am, and with a mother, if my mom had pulled that kind of crap, she would be in huge trouble. Huge. The hugest trouble. Huge. That was such a... It didn't... You know, I'm not exactly sure what it tried to accomplish. I mean, obviously, she knows that he doesn't care what they look like. It's not as if his love was contingent upon her being all disease-free and, like, rich and, like, whatever. Clearly, I tend to think that it was just more of a plot device because it didn't really ring that true. It just didn't. I didn't understand her decision to say that. It seemed like manufactured drama in that sense. Maybe it's from a different time. And I mean, I know there's a lot of fear around leprosy, which is an easily curable disease these days. But back then it was a big old mystery and everybody was terrified of it. Now, there may be some parallels to that.
maybe.
I mean, there just might be some parallels of people fearing a disease and being terrified and overreacting and taking these crazy precautions. There may be some memes available for out there to check out if you want to know what I'm talking about. But yeah, I guess maybe it does ring a little more true now that I think about it, now that I've lived through this past year.
Yeah. So Stephen, do you have a perspective that might inform us, like, other than it just being a plot device? Like, is there maybe something along the lines of, like, culturally or historically it was thing to do? I mean, I kind of get the whole, you know, remember me as I was, rather than me as this disfigured person afflicted with this terrible condition. And it almost seemed like, you know, she almost wished that she was dead instead, you know, like she was sort of living through this suffering life that wasn't worth living for her. But yeah. Is there some kind of context that you can bring to this?
Yeah. I think that the actual decision of the mother making that decision to not tell him, I think that may be more of the plot device. But what makes it good is that during this time period, you know, this wasn't something that was common in a way, but it wasn't something that was easily, you know, healed, not like today. So it was a horrible sentence on your life to have this, to have leprosy. And in this time period and regionally, this was a problem. And so people would, you know, live in these outskirts of towns and these valleys. And, you know, I've seen this movie a few times as an adult. And I think as a kid, I remember little bits of Ben-Hur. And really, there's just two scenes that I remember. And it's the chariot race and these scenes with the mom and the daughter that I did, they always stood out to me. And it almost like in this like a horror movie, the way that this valley is where they're living in the darkness and kind of with the shrouds like ghost. And as far as I know, it's very historically accurate. And this idea of not just the sadness of having to now live like this, but just I think that there's shame tied into it. There's this feeling of just complete loss where it's not just a cosmetic issue, but this complete loss of being on the outskirts of all society now, away from everyone. So it was very much a big deal at this time.
It seems like it was a living nightmare, and especially for someone who was in a, you know, had high social status previously. So it's a precipitous drop for them. And yeah, it kind of makes a little bit more sense. So yeah. So thank you for that.
No, absolutely. No, I mean, it was a nightmare to get leprosy, I would imagine, especially around the fear and the fact that it was incurable at the time. And yeah, it's essentially an ostracization sentence. And my favorite form of punishment is ostracization. And it shows how brutal it is. It's as you are kicked out of society and no one wants to, anything to do with you. So yeah, it's
and really having bad. It as well happen to these characters. It gives us a good opportunity to weave in some of the biblical narratives where they take Esther and Judah, take the mother and sister to go and see Jesus. And it's almost like this, it adds, instead of they're not just racing against the leprosy to get them there and the sister dying, but then it just adds to it the fact that when they get there, when they get to where Jesus is, he's in the middle of the crucifixion. And it just piles on this sense of loss and dread and everything. So I think that it worked really well for the movie, and I think that as a viewer, I could really see this tension and the sadness that's just, you know, just piling it on top of the imminent death and the sense of loss and the tragedy that's happening.
Right. There's even still a little spark of humor in there when they give the coin to the blind guy.
Yeah.
And then he hears that they have leprosy, so he dumps the coin out.
Yeah.
That was pretty funny. But anyway, yeah, this has been a lot of fun, and we'd love to have you back again. So people can check out your stuff at anarcho-christian.com and find the show notes more for this at actualanarchy.com/227. We're going to get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive right after this. And then next week, we're going to be doing the Ridley Scott version of Robin Hood. And speaking of leprosy, we did a Ridley Scott movie for Christmas, I want to say, Kingdom of Heaven, which featured the Leper King. So leprosy was a thing that afflicted all stripes, even kings. And it's, I don't know, gives us an example of how, despite even the recent 12 months of flattening the curve, we still all pretty much live better than kings of the past. So it's a good thing to remember, I guess, if we're ever getting down on things. But we'll be doing Ridley Scott's Robin Hood next week with Mike of the Battle for Liberty. And with that, we'll say maximum freedom, everyone. And we'll see you guys all next week. Happy Easter and peace out.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.